Hi, this is Barry Lissett, Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. What's wrong with using an average when you're working with numbers? In today's segment, we speak with Professor Sam Savage, a professor at Stanford University and the author of the new book, The Flaw of Averages. Professor Savage, welcome to the Science of Better. Let me begin by asking, what do you mean when you refer to the flaw of averages?
The flaw of averages was really discovered, over 100 years ago, and has been known as Jensen's inequality for all this time. With a name like that, no wonder no one knows what it means. Mm-hmm. But in the information age, it's sort of come back to bite us. With millions of people plugging numbers into spreadsheets, when they face an uncertainty, they typically plug in their best guess of the average value of that uncertainty, and are then under the false assumption that they will get the average value of the answer out. Although occasionally this happens, in general, it does not, and it leads to a whole class of systematic errors that I now call the flaw of averages.
Tell us about a cartoon in your book by the political cartoonist Jeff Danziger.
Right. Well, a famous case of the flaw of averages is something that many people have heard about in their statistics class. It concerns the statistician who drowns while crossing a river that is on average 3 feet deep.
Uh-huh.
Where the cartoon came from was about, 10 or 11 years ago, I came up with the title, The Flaw of Averages. I thought, what a great book title, and I actually wrote a contract with John Wiley. Then when I started to write the book, I realized that the flaw of averages just assures that everything is behind schedule, beyond budget, and below projection. There was no happy ending. This was a feel-bad book, and feel-bad books don't sell, and they're not fun to write.
Uh-huh.
But I thought the title was good enough, so I better reserve the real estate. So I ended up writing an article for the San Jose Mercury in 2000 called The Flaw of Averages. When the article came out, to my astonishment, it was graced by this magnificent cartoon by Jeff Danziger and of the statistician drowning in the river that's on average 3 feet deep. And so when I finally got around to writing the book, I persuaded him to do cartoons for the rest of the book as well, and it's been a really fun collaboration.
A lot of us think of Excel spreadsheets as a way to do our calculations easily. Why do you write in one of your chapters that it led to an epidemic of the flaw of averages?
Well, before spreadsheets, there were precious few people dealing in nonlinear functions of random variables. And what I mean by that is, you know, a random variable is a fancy word for an uncertain number. It's a word, by the way, I don't use myself. In fact, I make fun of it in the book. I refer to these things as red words. A function, of course, is something where you put numbers in and numbers come out. That's basically like a spreadsheet.
Uh-huh.
And where Jensen's inequality, which is what I call the strong form of the flaw of averages, comes in. And this is the place where when you plug in an average, you do not get the average of the output out. And we will need to come up with a concrete example in a second so everyone can grasp it. But where this shows up is in physics and some engineering and things like that, but not typically for the common man until the spreadsheet. And once the spreadsheet came out, you had millions of managers plugging numbers into these spreadsheets, and when they were uncertain about them, they'd plug in averages. And that led to the flaw of averages. I think it's important to give you a really concrete example here.
Okay, go ahead.
Suppose we're managing a project, and, it's a new website. And, we've got to write the content for the website. We got to go out and get the graphics. We got to set up the servers. We've got to do a deal with a bank on the credit cards. And let's just imagine now that there are 10 separate tasks that need to be accomplished, They can all be done in parallel by 10 teams. That's not a problem. It's not like one has to precede another. We're going to make this really simple. There are 10 tasks, and each one takes, on average, say, 3 months. So we're uncertain about each of these 10 tasks we need to accomplish, but we estimate that each one will take 3 months. So the boss comes in and says, when is the website going to be up and running? And, you know, you say, I don't know, boss. I don't know how long it's going to take to write the copy or get the graphics or do the servers. And the boss says, you know, I can't settle for that. Give me some numbers so I can plan. And you say, well, look, if you want to know, I mean, the average amount of time for each of these tasks is 3 months. Boss says, great. We'll be done in 3 months on average. Well, the fact is, there's only one chance in 1,000 you'll be done in 3 months. And believe me, this is not obvious to a lot of people. Why is there only one chance in 1,000 of being done in 3 months? Well, in order to be done in 3 months, each of these 10 tasks has got to come in at 3 months or less. And if 3 months is the average for each one, there's like a 50-50 chance probably that they're done in 3 months. So the chance that the entire project is done in 3 months is roughly the same as the chance of flipping 10 heads in a row.
Monte Carlo simulation apparently has been a favorite term on the TV show Numbers. You write of it and probability management as a cure, if you will, to the flaw of averages. Tell us a little bit so that a layman can understand.
Sure. Monte Carlo simulation grew out of the Manhattan Project. I think people have been doing it for centuries, but in its modern form, computerized and everything, was developed by Stanislaw Ulam and then programmed on John von Neumann's computers. And this was in the early 50s, very early 50s.
And the Manhattan Project was the atomic bomb?
Exactly. And this was not on the original atomic bomb. This was maybe later in the hydrogen bomb part of it. So it wasn't done in the 40s. Really, it was in the early 50s. But the basic idea is to bombard a model with random inputs. So that is, if you're not sure what the inputs are, then make a bunch of random ones, blast them through, and see what happens. And a nice analogy would be what you do before you climb on a ladder to paint the side of your house. You shake the ladder, and you see what it does. And that's really performing a Monte Carlo simulation of the ladder. And now, one of the things that people say about Monte Carlo, and it's in common use now. It's in use in spreadsheets, and there's been some magnificent technological development just in the last couple of years in this area. But one of the things that people say about Monte Carlo is, well, gee, a Monte Carlo simulation is only as accurate as the distribution you put into it, that is, the randomness you put into it. If you put in the wrong randomness, you don't learn anything. It's garbage in, garbage out.
Uh-huh.
Well, I completely disagree with that. The fact is that when you shake a ladder, you are not using the same distribution of forces that would appear on the ladder if you climbed on it. So I just wonder how many of your listeners are going to stop shaking ladders now that I've told them they've been using the wrong distribution for all these years.
Hmm.
No, of course you learn by shaking a ladder. So when you put a single number into a model, definitely garbage in, garbage out. When you put a probability distribution into a model, it's garbage in, insight out.
Ah, an important distinction. You devote a section of your book to what you call mindles. What are mindles?
Yeah, so, you know, as we think about the information age, it's really just, you know, still in its infancy. And I've given some thought to how it compares to the industrial age. And the industrial age, you know, was brought in by mathematicians and physicists and engineers, and then ultimately industrial designers who designed handles that allowed us to grasp the power of physics with our hands. So the whole thing was based on physics. But, you know, until you get that steering wheel on your car or the light switch on the wall, you know, the common man can really not access the physics. So in the information age, it's not physics we're harnessing at all. It's You don't grasp it with your hand. I mean, it's information. You grasp it with your mind. So the informational designer doesn't design a handle, but a mindle. And when I came up with Mindle, I thought it was a clever name, and I rushed out and tried to reserve Mindle.com.
But?
The last I looked, Joe Mindle of New York is just sitting on the darn thing.
Oh, gosh.
But it is a good concept, I think. And people in the information business must be cognizant of how their results are going to be understood and interpreted. And in my lectures, I usually give an example of a really terrible mindle, and that is the differential equations of motion of a bicycle. You know, I can write them down. I used to be able to solve things like that, but looking at it, you would never learn how to ride a bicycle. So it's a terrible mindle. In fact, to learn a bicycle, you really need to get on one and ride one and interact with it. And so a good mindle is one that connects the seat of the intellect to the seat of the pants.
Let's turn to the seven deadly sins. You're one of the few people I know who says there are seven deadly sins. No, I mean 11. What do you mean by seven deadly sins of averaging?
Well, I had been teaching at Cambridge University with my colleague Stefan Schultes over there, and he was one of the co-authors of our article on probability management. What we discovered really independently was that teaching the flaw of averages is very rewarding. People get it right away. It changes their behavior. I refer to it as like shooting fish in a barrel. If people have been plugging averages into their model, it's so easy to show them that it's wrong, and so easy to steer them towards a more correct outlook. And one day we were doing an executive education program over there and had just gotten to a classic case of the flaw of averages when someone jumped up out of their seat and ran out of the room and was gone for about 20 minutes. And at the next break, we asked what had happened. Well, they had apparently gotten themselves into a deal the day before. This was a businessman. They got themselves into a deal and suddenly realized that they had stepped into the flaw of averages, and they were trying to undo the deal on their cell phone, like right on the spot. Well, Stefan and I were so impressed, you know,
uh-huh.
Like someone in the church had, you know, gotten up and thrown down their crutches and walked out. I mean, you know, this person was cured. We thought, well, there must be, you know, a lot of other people who could be cured, and we need something like the seven deadly sins of averaging, right? And we went off this. We did this, you know, over a couple of pints at a bar after at a pub, I should say, after class, and we were wondering if we would come up with seven. Well, we came up with seven very quickly, and then we thought it'd be fun to keep adding more, but to keep calling them the seven deadly sins, because it's sort of a metaphor for our ignorance, you know, in this area. And so on the website, I'm going to keep publishing more.
Give us an example of one deadly sin.
Well, a very obvious one is we call it the family with 1.5 children. Would you sell children's socks in triples, right? Because, you know, on average there are three children's feet in a family, but you wouldn't sell socks in threes, and yet people do things that are just about that dumb when you get down to it.
We've been talking in some abstract terms, and some might think of your topic as purely academic. You devote a good portion of the book to showing why your problem with averages should be a problem for a lot of business people. And let's see if we can look at the problem in a way that our listeners can easily grasp. We can begin with a topic that concerns a lot of us who are over 50, retirement funds. Please give us your example about average returns of a 20-year account.
Sure. This is what the original article in the San Jose Mercury was about, by the way.
I see.
And so, you know, if on average your retirement account, say, earns 8% a year, and you model it as earning exactly 8% a year, year after year, then you can take out just enough money until you know that your funds will be exhausted at, you know, your expected demise. And that's just totally fallacious, because once you start adding uncertainty into the thing, even if it does average 8% a year, you're still going to have a 50-50 chance of going broke. So, in fact, it's an area in which Nobel Prize winner Bill Sharpe founded a company in 1996, 96 or 97 called Financial Engines, devoted to doing simulations of retirement funds. And now it's very common for people to do this in all walks of finance. You know, virtually everyone is doing Monte Carlo now for retirement modeling.
We were talking about the economic crisis today. Options and derivatives have been taking a beating in the press in the wake of what we've been calling the Great Recession. Do you think it's possible to explain a little bit about the topic?
First of all, options are just insurance. And you can bet that when people first, you know, came out with the idea of paying you if you died, right? There must have been a lot of people up in arms. Or paying you if your house burned down. Or paying you if you wrapped your car around a telephone pole. But, you know, we couldn't live without insurance. You know, things go wrong. Airplanes crash. We don't outlaw airplanes just because they crash once in a while. Financial engineering, I think, is actually a very, very exciting area. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, one of the most interesting applications of applied mathematics in recent history. I and others have now been working on ways to try to make this whole thing more transparent. The flaw of averages occurs when you plug a single number into a spreadsheet to represent an uncertainty. What a number of us have done here, this includes colleagues at Oracle and SAS, and Dan Feilstra at Frontline Systems, and some others, we've developed a new computer data type called the DIST, D-I-S-T, which stores thousands of numbers in the single cell of a spreadsheet, so that, you know, you really get in the mode of not thinking of a single number. You built a spreadsheet just as you did before, and every time you take a step, a thousand numbers get run through the spreadsheet. This gets us back to the bicycle analogy. Instead of a bicycle with a command line interface where you type lean left, hit the enter key, and then crash into a fire hydrant, this is like a bicycle with handlebars that you ride interactively. It's really an amazing development in Monte Carlo. And these new DIST data types are going to be supported, I think, quite widely. Certainly other firms are working on this now. The two packages that support the DIST data type right at this moment are the Risk Solver from Frontline Systems. I have my own less powerful software that does it as well, called Excel Sim.
I thought that we would go out on a personal note. You speak of your work as kind of a family affair when you bring up your father's work in statistics. Tell us a little bit about your father's work during World War II and about an article by Michael Schrage that brought your father back to mind many years later.
Having a famous father, you know, has its upsides and downsides. In many ways, I was openly envious of him, but the way in which I was most envious was the incredible relationships that he had developed with people like Milton Friedman, Fred Mosteller, other people during this during World War II, when they were working in this thing called the Statistical Research Group, and another famous name, Alan Wallace. My father, Alan Wallace, Milton Friedman. I didn't just have one towering role model. I had three. He wrote a very famous book, The Foundations of Statistics. It is so mathematical that I really can't even dig through most of it. My friend Michael Schrage emailed me one day about an article that my father had written that I had been unaware of. I have his complete works. It's a 700-800 page book published after his death.
I didn't mention your father's name, by the way. Could you tell us your father's name?
Oh, yes. His name was Jimmy Savage. He wrote some very fundamental papers with Milton Friedman in the early 50s. And was really sort of a founding father of decision analysis and so on. Michael Schrage relayed this paper to me that had been sticking under my nose for years in the back of this book. I hadn't read this complete works. And near the end was an article he'd written basically on what he thought statistics would look like in the future. And it must have been written just before his death in 71. So looking at it, I found that he really had a very, very modern view. He realized that computers would play a huge role in statistics. He realized that, visualization would play a huge role in statistics. He realized that statistics had to be presented in the form that people would really understand and build intuition around, and that was the concept of the Mindel in the book. So it was it's the way I finished the book. It was wonderful to be able to hear from him again, even though I couldn't ask any questions.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Professor Sam Savage of Stanford University about his book, The Flaw of Averages, published by John Wiley & Sons. Professor, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to this Science of Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.